This is Growing Grace, a daily teaching ministry of Palmetto Baptist Church in Greenville, South Carolina. In the book of Romans, Paul has a lot to say about the fallen human heart and the world around us. The world is under God's wrath, and our fallen human heart has no hope to be made right on our own. Some of the people in his audience would agree with Paul about the issues of the world, but they made a dangerous assumption that they were good with God. Today, Pastor Sam Horn will continue a sermon titled, Do I Have a Presumptuous Heart? Let's listen together so we can grow in grace.
It was clearly manifested. God made it clear to them, and they clearly understood it, and they suppressed it. And by the time we get to the end of chapter 1, what we discover is that these people are absolutely given over to the depravity of their heart. And Paul said it this way, though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things, and he's just given us a list of 17 things that they do, that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but they give approval to those who practice them. And there were a group of people who were listening to Paul, and they were saying, amen. We agree with that. Paul, we would never approve of those kinds of sins, and we actually approve of God's judgment on those sins. We agree that those people, those Gentile idolaters who are immoral and who are committing all of those sins, deserve God's righteous wrath. They deserve condemnation. They deserve to die. We agree. And that's the group of people that Paul turns to next, and he is going to ask them some very hard questions. But at the core of what he wants to know about them is this: are you presuming? Are you presuming something about God that you have no right to presume? Are you thinking something about God in relationship to yourself? And are you so convinced about what you have concluded that you're willing to continue living the way you're living with no regard for the fact that you might be under the righteous condemnation of God, just like the people you just condemned in chapter 1? Do you have a presumptuous heart? A presumptuous heart does two things. It rightly assesses the judgment of God on others, and that's what we're going to see here in this text, and it wrongly presumes the salvation of God on myself. In other words, the people in chapter 2 are literally looking at the people in chapter 1, and they are coming to the right conclusion about them. They are coming to the very exact thing that Paul was saying. Paul was looking at the people in chapter 1, and he is saying to them, you have no excuse, and you are under the righteous condemnation of God. And the people in chapter 2 are nodding their head. They have come to the right assessment about those people, but they have come to a very wrong assessment about themselves. And actually, as I was thinking about this, and as I was applying it to my own heart this week, I began to see how many places in my life I have this same tendency. And you probably have this tendency as well. It's very easy, and it's actually quite simple, to look at God's stated will and apply it to people who are not doing it and realize, okay, you are in big trouble. And then I look at my life, and there are glaring places where I am in violation of God's will, and I say to myself, well, it's not that bad. It's really not that bad for me. God will never do to me what he is going to do to them, because I am presuming on something, and that's where Paul is going to get today. And so here's the question I want us to ask ourselves as we look at this text. Do we have in our own hearts today as Christians any of the tendencies that we're going to see in the texts that we're about to read together. And I know Pastor Dusty read this to us, but I would like to ask you to read it out loud with me. And the reason I want to do that is that as you are mouthing these words, as you are saying these words, I want you to put yourself right in the middle of this, and I want you to ask yourself whether or not you fit the description that Paul is giving of the people in chapter 2. When I was researching this, and I was reading through what the commentators had to say, I came across a commentator who actually wrote a hypothetical letter to Paul from the people in chapter 2. And it really captured what I think is going on here, and I want to read it to you. It was written by a commentator by the name of Christopher Ashe, and he was thinking about this deeply, and he thought, you know, I'm going to write a letter from the people in chapter 2 to Paul about the people in chapter 1. And this is what he said. He said, "Dear Paul, I have just read the second half of chapter 1 in Romans. I congratulate you on a vigorous, refreshing exposé of evil. I agree wholeheartedly with you that it is disgusting when people not only behave badly, but actually approve of bad behavior." And that's what we saw in chapter 1. "It did me good to read your chapter. You will be glad to know that I, for one, do not for a moment approve of those who practice these terrible things you wrote about in verse 32. On the contrary, I recognize them for the evils they are and agree that such people are without excuse. I look forward to chapter 2. Yours sincerely." Now here's Paul's answer to a person who would write a letter like that. Let's read this together. "Therefore, you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself because you, the judge, practice the very same things. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who practice such things. Do you suppose, O man, you who judge those who practice such things and yet do them yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? Or do you presume on the riches of his kindness and forbearance and patience, not knowing that God's kindness is meant to lead you to repentance? But because of your hard and impenitent heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself on the day of wrath when God's righteous judgment will be revealed. Do I have a presumptuous heart?" And when we think about that, Paul is going to lay out five realities about the judgment of God that is designed to come right into our life and pierce into the kind of thinking that goes on in the mind of a person in chapter 2 who says to God and who says to Paul, "No, the judgment of God will never fall on me." When Paul asks, "Do you suppose that the judgment of God will not fall on you?" When you see that in verse 3, "Do you suppose, O man, that you will escape the judgment of God?" The person reading that in chapter 2 would look at Paul and would say to Paul, "Well, of course we're going to escape the judgment of God. Of course we're going to escape the judgment of God. We're going to escape the judgment of God because of who we are. We are Jews. We are his chosen people. God would never judge us. God would never condemn us the way that we know and approve that he's going to condemn the Gentiles. God is never going to judge us because of who we are. He's never going to judge us because of what we have. We have the law of Moses. We have the circumcision of Abraham. We have the tabernacle and the temple of David and Solomon. We have the feasts. To us is the great promise of the Messiah that was given to the patriarchs. God would never judge us the way he's going to judge them because of who we are and because of what we have. And he would certainly never judge us because of what we do. We obey that law. We tithe on the smallest thing. If we go to the marketplace and we buy a little bit of mint, We take 10% of that and we tithe. If we are very careful about how far we walk on the Sabbath. We are very careful about not touching anything unclean. We are super careful about making sure that when we bear our young, we offer sacrifices like Moses told us to do on certain days. We take them and we circumcise them on the eighth day. God would never judge us like he's going to judge the pagan Gentiles. He'll never judge us because of who we are, because of what we have, and because of what we do. Now let me ask you for a moment to ask those same questions about yourself. Have you concluded in your life that there's something that you know God hates, that you've tolerated and you do, and you're past the point of even caring about it, and you have convinced yourself that the judgment of God will never come on your life because of that thing, because of who you are? I'm a Christian. I'm not like those idol worshipers in India or in Africa. I don't worship the false god of the nations. I am a Christian. I live in a Christian country, and I go to a Christian church, and I am part of a Christian family. God would never judge me. Or maybe you've concluded that God is going to tolerate all of that wickedness in your life because of what you have. I have church membership. I went to a Christian school. I've got a diploma from a Christian high school or a Christian university. I've got a little certificate that I worked at a Christian camp, and they were so pleased with my work, they gave me a little award for that. I have a certification that I was baptized. I have a certification that I was confirmed. I have all my attendance certificates from Summer Vacation Bible School. I've got all of that. God would never judge me because of who I am and because of what I have. And he certainly isn't going to judge me because of all the things that I do for him. I sing in the choir. I teach a Sunday school class. I show up and volunteer. I work down in the nursery. I give. I tithe. I do all of these things. Surely God is never going to judge me. You see how easy that comes in our lives? And Paul says, when you're like that, and you're presuming on the kindness and on the mercy and on the patience of God, you are in danger. You have fooled yourself into a place where you think you are safe from the judgment of God. And so there are five things you need to know about that judgment. And if you really understand these five things, it will explode that presumption out of your heart. Thing number one, God's righteous judgment is inevitable. And it is inescapable. Read the text. Therefore, you have no what? You have no excuse. Oh man, whoever you are who judges, every one of you who judges, you have no excuse. You have rightly concluded what God is going to do to the people in chapter 1, you've made a righteous judgment. You've made a correct assessment of that. In other words, this is not a text where Paul is condemning people for judging. He's actually arguing that you've assessed the situation correctly in chapter 1. Those people really are, as I've told you, Paul said, under the righteous condemnation of God. But so are you. Because the minute you come to a right conclusion about the people in chapter 1, you are condemning yourself. And here's why you're condemning yourself. You are doing the very same kinds of things as a Jew that they're doing as a Gentile. And the judgment of God is coming on anyone and everyone. And each one, anyone, general, everyone, collective, each one, individual, every human being on the planet is going to stand before a righteous judge to be judged. The writer of Hebrews says, it is appointed unto man once to die, but after what? After this, the judgment. The judgment of God, Paul says, is inevitable and it is escapable. And here is what you need to know. You are without excuse. first thing out of his mouth. He gets this letter, hypothetically, Paul, thank you, I just read the second half of Romans 1, wonderful words, totally agree with you, wholeheartedly, amen, can't wait for chapter 2. Paul says, thanks for writing, you are without excuse. Not, how's it going, how's the family, how's the camel herd, how's the tent, you know, how was your trip? How was the Feast of Passover? Did you have a good time at the unleavened bread ceremony? How did it go? That's not what he does. He looks right at these people, and he singles out one of them. Sort of he's having a conversation with all of them through this one person, and he says, I want you to know something. You are without excuse. When you and I stand before the judgment of God, we are going to be without excuse. Why is that? Well, that's because of the second thing Paul wants them to know, and that is that the judgment of God is according to truth. And you can see that in verse 2. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who practice such things. Now, do you see that in your text? Most of you have an ESV Bible. I actually like the translation that the Authorized Version has. I actually think the Authorized Version gets it right. I think it's better than what you have here in the ESV. The Authorized Version actually says, we know, we see that the judgment of God is according to truth. What does Paul mean by that? Well, he means that when God judges a man, that judgment is fully accurate. God will never misjudge someone who stands before him. That judgment, when God renders it in chapter 1, is fully accurate. I mean, these people really have denied the existence of God. They have refused to glorify him as God. They have rejected his goodness, and they have rebelled against his authority. And the whole chapter is example after example after example of how and why this has happened. And by the time you get to the end, Paul says the whole Gentile world is practicing these things, even though they know that these things are worthy of death. And not only do they do them, they celebrate them. They promote them. They give hearty approval to the ones that do them. And Paul's answer to that is when they stand before the God of heaven, who they don't think exists, he is going to look at them and he is not going to take, well, I didn't know as an excuse. There is no excuse. And the judgment of God, when it falls on you, Jew, who has made that assessment with me in chapter 1, you too are going to be judged. And the judgment is going to penetrate into the reality of your life. It is going to be fully accurate, and it is going to be wholly righteous. It will be just. And when the God of heaven renders the decision about your life, based on what he truly knows about you, a judgment that is accurate and just, you will have no excuse. Because the nature of that judgment is true. It's about what's really going on in your life. And what Paul's going to say is you really have been doing the very same things that the Gentiles who you despise and you agree should be under the wrath of God have been doing. And if I'm a good Jew, I'm looking at Paul and I'm saying to Paul, what in the world are you talking about? I mean, I'm not perfect. I certainly blow it here and there. But man, I would never do the kinds of things that you talked about in Romans chapter 1 that the Gentiles have been doing with all kinds of hardness of heart and all kinds of impurity and impiety and immorality and injustice. Their world is full of idols. It's full of immorality. And we Jews would have nothing to do with that. And Paul says, really? Are you sure about that? A little bit later on in the book, he's going to bring up an example of idolatry that plagued Israel from the very beginning. He's going to talk about right after they left Egypt. Remember that story? They come out of Egypt. They're all gathered at the Red Sea. God parts the waters. He takes them across. They go 3 days' journey into the wilderness. They come to a mountain, Mount Horeb. And that is a mountain where God is going to give them the light of the Torah that no other nation has. And as Moses goes up to the top of that mountain to to receive that light, he remains up there for 40 days. And the people down below decide, I don't know what happened to him. That mountain was a pretty scary thing, the lightning and the thundering, and I mean, he's gone. He's not coming back. And so they turned to Aaron, and they said to Aaron, make us gods. And you know the story. They make a golden calf, and they start worshiping that golden calf with the very same immorality that they learned at Egypt when the Egyptians used to worship their calves and their idols. And Paul is going to remind the Jew who judged the people in chapter 1, you have been doing as a nation the very same thing. A little bit later on in the journey, in the book of Deuteronomy, just before Moses dies, he reminds them of another incident where the whole nation went wholeheartedly after idols in the days of Balaam, the false prophet. After Balaam prophesied blessing upon them, he whispered to Balak, and he said to Balak, listen, I know how to get these people to sin, and you get them down there with those Amorite women, and those Amorite women are going to teach them about the Amorite gods, and part of the worship of that is immorality, and they're going to engage in that, and God is going to have to judge them. And that's exactly what happened. And Moses said, I want you to remember on that day at the city of Pure, when you committed the idolatry and the immorality around the Baals of the Amorites, God slew 24,000 of you. So when you stand here and say, we would never commit idolatry, we would never commit immorality, look back at your history. And maybe you and I are here and we would say, I would never do this, I would never do that. Wait a minute. Look back at your history. And then Paul is going to remind them later of another incident that took place in Jesus' own day. In Moses' day, they were guilty of immorality and idolatry. In Jesus' day, they were guilty of malice and covetousness, which is massively mentioned in the last part of chapter 1. Why do the pagans do what they do? They are full of malice and they are full of covetousness, which is what Paul said in chapter 1, verse 29 and verse 30. And the Jews were just as full of malice and covetousness. And there's an incredible example of this in Jesus' own day. It shows up in Matthew 21 and in Mark 11 and in Luke 19 and again in John chapter 2. The temple that God had given to his people had a particular location called the Court of the Gentiles. God set aside this part of the temple so that any Gentile who wanted to come and learn about him and pray to him and worship him would have a place even though they weren't Jews. And this place was called the Court of the Gentiles. By Jesus' day, the Jews were doing something very different with that space in the temple than God intended. If you stop and think about what they were doing, they had made a huge business of selling things to God's people when they came to worship. They did it like this. They said to God's people, listen, when you come to pay the temple tax, you can't use the shekel in your pocket.
Thank you, Pastor Sam. We'll continue this sermon next time on Grow in Grace. Today's speaker, Dr. Sam Horn, is the pastor for preaching and vision at Palmetto Baptist Church. PBC meets at 2730 Anderson Road, Greenville, South Carolina. If you live locally, come join us for a morning worship service at 9 or 10:45 a.m. You can find us online at pbcpowdersville.org. If you'd like more information about Palmetto or this sermon series, reach out to radio@pbcpowdersville.org. Thanks for listening. Join us again next time so together we can grow in grace.